This is where I graduated high school, and at that time, First Church had a school. So I, like, my class ring says First Church of God, right? Like, and this is where I got married, and this is where I had my first kid. And so Greene County has a big place, or actually, I'm old. Greene County has a place in my heart, right? I've been a lot of places, and so what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself at the beginning, because it's going to take you just a minute to go, she looks just like her mom, but she sounds just like her dad, right? And so while you're trying to figure all that out, I'll let you know that I do currently live in Beaumont, Texas, and I pastor North Point Community Church, but I also, in the past about 2.5 years, have started a ministry called Rugged Devotion, and we do lots of different things, but a big part of what we do is we go into corporate organizations, we go into churches and leadership structures, we go into districts and conferences where pastors gather, and we teach people about leadership and diversity and how all of that works together and how you can lead people, and leading people always isn't just this checklist of things that you need to do, that it's also about the people. And when you can invest in the people, then you can lead, right? And so it's has this really weird organic flow to it, and people are like, what does Rugged Devotion do? And I'm like, what do you need it to do, right? Because that's how Jesus works. Jesus was all about the people, right? Now, can I just tell you that I had this really good sermon ready? And people are still trying to decide. First of all, they're not really sure if a woman should preach at all. And then they can't decide if what I do is preach, because people don't always walk away with 3 points to put in their pocket, right? And so I would call it a sermon. I don't know if I got to preach it, if you would call it a sermon. But can I tell you that God kind of wrecked me a little bit as I prayed over this? And you haven't seen me in 25 years. What if I just told you a little bit about my story, right? And so what if tonight was just a little bit more like a testimony time than it was like, Rachel brought down the fire, right? Because I can do that. I'm Charlie Heater's daughter, right? Somebody asked me tonight, do you talk loud? I don't even really need this, right? I spoke at a church a few weeks ago. They run about 6:50. The power went out. And they're like, what are we going to do? And I'm like, let's keep having church. Right? I just cranked it up a notch and we kept going. So I can do that. But can I just share with you kind of what God has done in my life since I left Greenville? So my husband and I got married here, and we actually traveled back in to get married. It was kind of a really weird deal. It's where Dad pastored at the time, and it's where we were going to get all the free stuff, right? And so we traveled back here to get married. My whole wedding party traveled in. I think everybody who got married in this church had a big wedding, right? Like, it was a beautiful time, and my husband and I left, and we moved to Texas. It was there in Texas that we decided that we wanted to start a family. And it didn't really happen. And we went years. And the doctor said, Miss Medlin, you don't have what it takes to have a baby. You don't have. But we can try this one way, and let's see if maybe, just maybe, you could have a baby. And so we got pregnant with our first, and it was this really troubled pregnancy, so much so that our best option was to move back home with mom and dad, and that's why Daniel was born here at Tacoma, right? Because I spent the last 3 months of my pregnancy in bed, except that night we went fishing and I climbed the fence, right? We won't talk about that part. So when I delivered Daniel, the doctor said, you just need to count your blessings. Now, what I haven't told you is that when I met my husband at Mid-America Bible College and we decided to get married, I said, Travis, how many kids do you want to have? Like, I kind of, and he said, oh, I was thinking 6. And I said, 6? And he said, yeah, 6 would be good. And I'm like, okay. So when the doctor said that 1 was all we were going to have, I was like, this is going to be weird. When Daniel was 9 months old, I started feeling a little sick. Wasn't really sure what was going on. I said, honey, I'm not feeling real good. He said, you should go to the doctor. I went to the doctor. He said, Mrs. Medlin, you're going to have a baby. I said, you told me I couldn't do that. He said, you're going to. She was a miracle. Absolute miracle. Now, you know, God has this habit of, he's like, oh, you thought that was a miracle. Watch this. When she was 3 months old, I said, honey, I'm not feeling too good. He goes, oh, no. Right? There's 18 months between my first two kids, and there's 13 months between my second and my third, and I had 3 and 3 years. I was pregnant from 2000 to 2000, and I don't know. The day I delivered my last kid, I wore an outfit to the hospital, and Travis looked at me, and he said, do you think when we get home, maybe you could burn that? He's like, I think that's the only thing you've worn in the last 6 years. And we were just elated that God would bless us with the things that the world said we couldn't have. But in the back of my mind, I kept remembering that he said he wanted 6 kids. And so then I was like, okay, God, am I going to die early? And like his second wife is going to give him another set? Like, how is this going to work? Because I want to live to be 99. I told somebody that the other day, and they're like, you're crazy. And I'm like, oh, honey, prop me up in the pulpit, and I'll die right there. Right? But if God wanted to take me early and my husband gets 6 kids another way, that's fine. We went to a church in Houston at the time, and Houston is a pretty diverse city, and they kind of call it the melting pot. And we realized early on that there was this pocket of homeless people that really needed to be ministered to, and we partnered with a couple other organizations. And I know sometimes when we think of homeless people, we think of the kind of the bearded guy on the corner with the sign, and he's got a backpack, and maybe he's traveled some. And the average age of a homeless person in Houston is 19. And they usually travel in packs, and they learn that the only thing they own is themselves, and so it's not infrequent for them to sell themselves to live. And I know that TV and industry, they kind of make that sort of fancy, and you think, oh, they're making big bucks if they're doing that. Can I tell you that I've talked to girls who've sold themselves for $3 so they could buy a hamburger, right? And we realized that sometimes people make those choices because they don't know any other choice to make. And if we try to drag them into uncomfortable situations, if we try to say, well, if just all the homeless people would come to church, we would be happy to save them. We would be happy to lead them to the Lord. They just need to come to church. Those people sleep under bridges every night. The last thing they want to do is be confined to a building. Scares them to death. So we realized if we got this space that was kind of downtown, and it was protected by 3 different buildings, and it was a parking lot, and we said, if we started having church like this, maybe we could start having church for the homeless, right? So the other organization, they really kind of took the ball on planning the services and all that, and we were just kind of doing the legwork in the back and making sure that there were enough chairs and there was food that night. And we started to realize that all of these mothers kept coming, and they carried cardboard boxes on one side and babies on the other. And they would sit down, and they would open a cardboard box, and they would put their baby in it. And I met a little boy. He was almost 2.5 years old, and he didn't know how to walk because he'd spent his entire life in a box. So we got to praying, and we got to thinking, and we said, what if we could do, and again, I'm shortening this story because we only have a few minutes, right? So know that everything we did was legal, because here in a minute it's going to sound like we took a bunch of babies, and that's not what we did, okay? We did through all the legal parameters, right, to become legal in aiding these mothers in giving their children to us for a season so that they could better themselves. And we would find job resources, and we would give them tools that they needed. When remember, I've decided to tell you this part of the story when, remember, I have a 3, a 2, and a 1-year-old. And all the ladies in my church started fostering, and I said, that is so wonderful. I'm so glad you're doing that. I have plenty of diapers, so if you need some, you call me. I'll bring them over. I have no intention of taking in somebody else's baby. I got plenty of my own. I get a call from my friend, and she said, Rachel, I just picked up a baby from the hospital. He's really sick. Most babies that we got in that circumstance were detoxing. She said, on top of that, he's got RSV, and she's like, he's cried for days. She said, can you just come and help me? Can you just come and give me a break? Can you hold him for just a minute? And I said, sure, Michelle, I would love to. It was pretty common for us to ask what the babies look like, because remember, in a diverse city, it's kind of like opening jelly beans. You never know what color you're going to get, right? And I would say, what does he look like? And usually I would get like, he's Hispanic, or he's African American, or she is Asian. And she said, he looks just like your husband, Travis. And I said, well, that's weird. And sure enough, we walked in that house, and that baby was, I don't know if you've ever met my husband, but he pale, like translucent, right? It was a pale little baby with big blue eyes. And I didn't believe in love at first sight until I laid eyes on that baby. She handed him to my husband, and remember, he'd cried for about 48 hours at this point. And my husband took him and wrapped him up in his arms and laid him on his shoulders, and he just went to sleep. I said, I see what you're doing, God. And any of you who are parents know that one is kind of wild, two kind of wrecks your house, but when you get that third one and you're outnumbered, it doesn't matter how many you get after that, right? They're going to win every time. And I thought, sure, we'll just bring in another one. And I thought we were just going to do the foster thing. That's what all my other friends were doing. We'd loved him for about 3 weeks, and we realized that mom had signed over her parental rights. It was a little bit more than she could handle, and we'll never badmouth a birth mom in this story, because they make the best choices they can in the middle of terrible situations. And so we started the process of foster to adopt. He lived in our home for 18 months. We loved him. We cared for him. We named him. He had a pretty severe medical disorder because of all the drugs that had been in his system. It wasn't uncommon for him to have 24 grand mal seizures in a day. That's a seizure an hour. For us to function, we learned how to go to the grocery store and have a seizure. We learned how to go to church and have a seizure. 2 weeks before all the paperwork was final, we show up in court, and there's a gentleman there that I don't recognize. I can tell you a lot of ugly details about the story, but going to just tell you that in the process, that gentleman not only threatened my life, but he threatened the life of my children that I already had. He threatened the life of my husband. He came to church and tried to steal the baby out of the nursery. It was like something off a movie. He was blood related. And so I'm not here to argue that blood is thicker than water. I'm not here to tell you anything about that story, but can I just tell you that he wasn't the best man I've ever met. After a long, lengthy court battle, the judge decided that Idaho was the best place for my baby. I've never lived in Idaho. So early on a February morning, a CPS worker that I had never met pulled into my driveway and took my baby out of my arms and put him in the back of a seat of her car, strapped him in a car seat that I'd never seen and never saw him again. My grandpa told me one time when I was a little girl, he said, sometimes, Rachel, there are things in your life that hurt so bad you don't have an emotion for it. And I can remember that moment, that void. I couldn't even cry. Are you kidding me, God? I gave you everything. I don't know if you remember when I was a kid here, but I was all in for Jesus. I was not the roustabousters like a lot of Green County kids. Now, I might have cruised the strip once in a while, but I was nice. I had given myself to God and the ministry. I had surrendered all that I was early in my life. And here I am, smack dab in the middle of my biggest fear. The minute I became a mother, my biggest fear was not that one of my kids would die. Because if we believe in what we say we believe, if we believe in the gospel that we're preaching, then we don't have to worry about life and death because we're going to spend forever with people. What I was worried about is that somebody would take my baby and I would spend the rest of my life wondering if they were safe, if they were loved, if they were cared for. And suddenly one day I woke up in the middle of my biggest fear. And I said, God, what are you doing? God and I have this really cool relationship. I know for Elijah he whispered, but I'm pretty stubborn and so he has to boom. And I remember that he boomed deep in my soul that day and he said, Rachel, I know you don't trust your faith enough, but I trust your faith enough. Watch this. And I said, God, I trust you. Not sure I trust my faith right now. I thought I had always had really big faith. But my God's never failed me. My story, it may not look like I wanted it to, but I'm going to keep walking in this. Obviously, I needed time to heal from that. So we put our foster license on the shelf for a while. And I continued in raising kids. We bought a farm. We taught our kids how to run iPads and slaughter chickens. It was amazing. I homeschooled. I made homemade granola. I'm telling you, it was crazy. And then one day God said, remember when you said you would give me all of you? And I said, yeah. And he said, do you think I gave you that set of lungs for nothing? And I said, God, there aren't a lot of women who do what I do. There aren't a lot of women who take the mic and share the word. There aren't a lot of women who can walk into a room and they go, oh, she's going to share the word. Usually I walk into a room with my husband and they go, you the preacher? He goes, no. God said, I didn't ask you what other people thought. I asked you if you meant it when I said, are you all in? I said, yeah, God, I'm all in. I don't know what this looks like. I don't know what this process looks like, but let's see what happens. Now, I thought when I said, God, yeah, I'll do whatever. We're all in. If you want to use my voice, use my voice. I thought that meant that, like, in about 2 weeks, I'd be a preacher, right? God has some interesting path choices, doesn't he? Because it wasn't very long after that I was at a district function for our churches, and I met this young couple, and they were starting a church plant. I was pretty involved in my church. I was running a couple of ministries, and I loved to hear them talk and the excitement in their voice and all that they were going to do in this super diverse community and how they were going to plant this church that was so many different colors and have all this outreach. And I said, oh, my gosh, that is so great. And she said, we're looking for 100 people who will pray. 100 people who will pray for the launch of this church. And I said, I'll be one of those. I got babies on all the hips. We've got farms and animals. And my bio says I'm a goat midwife. That's a whole nother sermon we don't have time for. But, like, that was my life. And I said, so I can pray. Every week they would send us emails on specific things to pray for. And I remember this one day we got this email that said, would you pray that our church is diverse? Would you pray that our church reflects our community? And I thought, well, that's easy. Sure. And so I started to pray, God, this church plant, would you please allow it to have diversity? Would you allow it to reflect its community? Would you allow it to be led in a beautiful way? Would you? And the words flowed so easy. It was also about that same time that God began to birth in my heart what it would be like to not only pursue the ministry path and go back to school and be a pastor, but to foster again. And I thought, oh, that's weird, God. That's a whole lot of hats. And he said, just watch. And I thought, how am I going to tell Travis this? Right? Remember we were driving in the car one night and I said, honey, I need to talk to you about something. And he said, yeah, I need to talk to you something too. I'm going to tell mine first. I think we should foster again. And I went, oh, I don't have nothing to say. He said, that's a first. So we started fostering again. And, you know, because I felt like that God had allowed me to understand what it's like to love them and give them back, then we started this process of loving these babies, these detoxing infants. I don't know if you know a whole lot about that, but it usually takes about 3 months for a baby to detox completely. And in that time, they shake and convulse, and there's sleepless nights, and I like to wear them next to me so that they can have skin-to-skin contact, and I got these little T-Rex arms, right? And so my kids had to learn how to do everything because I always had a baby strapped somewhere. Over the years, we had 17 babies come through our house. 17 babies that God let us pray over and bless. And in the whole time, resource parents so that when they were ready and stable, we could say, you got this, mama. You got this, daddy. You can do this. And I said, This is kind of what the church does. This is a Jesus thing. I feel this. Around Christmas time, one particular year, I already had a house full of babies. It was pretty common for people who have foster kids to kind of find a respite home during the holidays because they kind of want to spend the holidays with their own family. And so my husband and I felt pretty confident in the fact that we got special permission to have extra kids in our house for the holidays. And so if you were to ever come and visit me during those years, you knew when you walked in the door, somebody was handing you a baby, right? Mom and Dad would come to visit, and I'd say, here's your baby, here's your baby. Just keep that one fed. Sometimes we'd have 7 and 8 babies in the house. And so I get a call right before Christmas that says, Mrs. Medlin, there's been a baby born. His mom is incarcerated. You can't pick him up yet because the warden's away on Christmas. Can we bring him to you after Christmas? And I said, yeah. I said, can you tell me a little bit about him? And they said, he's a little African-American baby, and in about 3 months, his mom will be released, and at that point, we can make some decisions about the rest of her life and get her some services so that she can start this journey. And I said, okay, I'll sign up for 3 months. We love to tell Jacob this part. We met at a 7-Eleven parking lot, and they handed me a baby. Right? And I remember when they handed him to me, and I looked at him, and I looked at the worker, the caseworker, and I said, you told me he was African-American. And she said, he is. And I said, this baby white. Right? Now, what I didn't know is that it's not uncommon for African-American people to be born our skin tone. And they kind of grow into their pigment. And she says, just give him a minute. Right? And so as the days went on, I learned more and more about what it meant to take care of somebody from a different culture. There's a lot there. Like, they should have come with a book. I'm just going to tell you, right? Their body doesn't produce any of their own oils. I just had 3 kids in 3 years. We used one bottle of baby lotion that I probably got at a baby shower in that family life center the whole time I had my first set. And in the first 2 weeks, I'd already gone through a case of lotion. I didn't know what to do with his hair. Mom gets out. What I didn't realize is on the first parental visit, she was kind of vetting us. She's asking me all these questions about my other kids, about our lifestyle, about where we go to church. I've always been chatty, so I was just answering the questions. So excited that she was going to be able to get her baby back. 2 weeks later, we go for the next family visit. She doesn't show. The phone rings about 15 minutes into when the session was supposed to start, and she's on the other line, and she says, "You know, I've really been thinking, and I just think Miss Rachel should adopt him." I didn't sign up for this, God. The caseworker looked at me, and she said, "Mom picked you. So what?" I said, I should probably talk to my husband. Travis and I talked about it, and we went back to the caseworker, and we said, "We've already loved him for 3 months. We would love to love him forever, but can you assure us that there is no one in his culture who can take care of him? Because the last thing I want to do is remove him from family that looks like him." There's something very humbling about holding a baby and knowing you're the only person in the world willing to love him. We started the adoption process for Jacob when he was 10 months old. The hospital called. They said, "Miss Medlin, birth mom's had another baby. Can you come and get him when he's well?" I said, "What? I did not sign up for this." She said, "Well, we kind of need to know in 20 minutes because in 20 minutes we'll put him in the Texas system." I called my husband. I said, "There's been a baby." We called the caseworker back and we said, "Sure, we'll go through the process. We'll adopt him. When can we pick him up?" And she goes, "Well, we think he was," because remember, they're only 10 months apart. "We think he was born about 2.5 months early, so we figure he'll be in the NICU for about 3 months. So when he's well, we'll call you." And I said, "Hang on a minute. You just asked me if I would adopt him, and I said yes. And then you said now that I've accepted this little baby as my own, that I got to wait 3 months to see him?" She said, "Yeah." She said, "Foster parents don't have any parental rights in the NICU." I said, "She don't know my God." I called my prayer chain. I said, "Guys, I'm not trying to cause a scene. I don't want to uproot anything. But come on, can I at least lay eyes on my baby? Can we pray that I can at least see him?" I get a call from the caseworker at the hospital. She said, "Miss Medlin, I'm here on a Saturday and there ain't nobody else here. If you'll sneak up and you don't say anything, don't ask any questions, don't tell anybody who you are, I'll hold him up to the NICU window and you can see him." I said, "I'll be there." I got up that morning and I went to get dressed, and I'm a pretty modest dresser. I'm a good Church of God girl. God said, "I need you to wear this sweater that you usually wear, but I usually wore this sort of t-shirt thing underneath it." And he said, "Don't wear the t-shirt today." Now, I know you think, God doesn't talk to you like that. Yes, he does. You're not in my head. And I said, "God, I don't dress like this." He said, just trust me. And I said, "Okay." So I put the sweater on. I went and got in the car. My husband goes, "What are you wearing?" I said, "God told me to wear this." He said, "I hope God tells you how to dress more often." We go up to the hospital, and they take this little tiny bassinet, because he was 3.5 pounds when he was born, and they turn it around, and I know that I was supposed to be quiet, but the only thing that I could say was, "Oh, he's black." And the nurse's eyes get about this big, and she goes, "They didn't tell you?" And I go, oh, I knew he was black, but he was black already. He was ebony, beautiful dark skin, tiny, tiny little baby. We start FaceTiming the kids, and I think my mom and dad were there, and we're showing everybody what he looks like, and we're trying really hard to be quiet. And the nurse comes in, and she says, "Who are you?" And I looked at the caseworker, and the caseworker went. And I said, "I'm his foster mom. hope to adopt him when he's well. She said, would you like to hold him? I looked at the caseworker. She went, I said, I would love to hold him. He's 11 days old at this point. This is way before COVID. She said, Mrs. Medlin, all the gloves and the mask and the gowns are over there. If you'll just do all that, then. And I said, is he sick? What's going on? She said, oh, Mrs. Medlin, nobody's touched him yet. He has so many drugs in his system, we're not allowed to touch his skin. I said, he's 11 days old. She said, I am, but we can't touch him. I said, is this mandatory? She goes, no. I said, give me my baby. All 3.5 pounds of him fit right there where my sweater wasn't. And for the first time in his life, he got skin-to-skin contact with a mama. The nurse said, when do you want to take him home? And I said, when can I take him home? And she said, he has to be able to eat 5 cc's. I said, how much is he eating now? She said, nothing. She said, we try to get him to eat, he won't eat. She said, do you want to try? Now remember, I've not asked or said anything. I was good, just like the caseworker asked me to. And every time the nurse asked me questions, and I answered. And when that day was over, not only had I held my baby, I had fed him his first cc of formula, and I got full parental rights in the NICU. They gave me free parking passes and lunches and breakfast. We got to go 3 times a day and feed him and care for him. 21 days later, remember they said he was going to be in the hospital for 3 months. 21 days later, they called and said, Ms. Medlin, he's really tiny, but you can take him home. There's nothing wrong with him. He just don't have his ears. Now, God fixed that later. If you meet Carter, he has all of his ears. Watch them grow overnight. That's a whole nother sermon. The doctor came in the day that we brought Carter home, and he gathered all the nurses around, and he was from the Middle East, and he and I had had a conversation because he didn't understand about adoption, and he didn't understand what we were doing, and he said, this baby isn't from your culture. This baby isn't even yours. He's like, how could you? You're going to bring him in, and you're going to... And the thing that he couldn't believe was that I was willing to give him my name. He said, this baby will have your last name? And I said, oh, yeah. He said, I do not understand. He said, in my country, we build really nice orphanages. We take really good care of the kids, but we can't imagine how we would ever invite anybody else into our family. And I said, oh, let me tell you about my God. He's all about growing families in really wild ways. He gathered the nurses in that day, and he said, I want you guys to see what happens when love enters a tragedy. He said, this baby would have laid here and he would have died. He had all of his brain. He could breathe. He was almost kind of eating. He said, we could have done everything medically possible. And he still wouldn't have made it. But he said, people stepped into his life that loved him and everything changed. That's God. Real quickly, I'll tell you how we got the third one. Remember how many kids my husband said we were going to have? Yeah. It's my daughter's birthday. Her 14th birthday. Those of you who have had kids, if you have them in that big of a span, I'm so sorry because I feel your pain. We get a call from the hospital. Ms. Medlin, birth mom's had a baby. This one's pretty healthy. You can come pick him up tomorrow. Do you want him? And I went, oh, I should probably call my husband. Now remember, I got 20 minutes. Travis had taken Emily. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this because when I was little, we weren't allowed to go to the movies. But Travis had taken Emily to the movies. He did not answer the phone. God said, remember, your husband said he was going to have 6 kids. I said, okay, God, here we go. I called the CPS worker back. I said, well, take him. I texted my husband. It's a boy. We We didn't even tell our family. We didn't tell anybody. We got him so fast that we sent out a picture to a family text chat that just had me and Travis and the baby. And we said, meet Tobias. That's getting the baby fast. In all of this process of adopting the children and working through life and going back to ministry school, I began to further myself in what it meant to be in pastoral ministry. And then God started writing a story. I love the story of Ruth, and I love how God works in Ruth's story, but there's this tiny little part in Ruth's story that sometimes people miss. There's this tiny little part when Ruth shows up in Boaz's field and Boaz meets her for the first time and he looks at her and he prays this prayer of blessing over her. He says, may God be, this is the Rachel Medlin paraphrase, right? I know you're very learned, so please don't critique me, right? May God be in your future. May you be cared for and cared over. Do you think that Boaz knew when he prayed that prayer that he was going to be the answer to his own prayer? How many times in our life do we pray prayers and we think it's somebody else's responsibility? God be with the homeless people. God be with the people over there. Oh God, that family really needs help. Be with them. Are we willing to walk that story out if God says, put on your boots, it's about to get deep? Remember that prayer that I prayed about that church? That church that was a church plant, that church that was just starting out, that church that was just starting out as I was starting on my ministry path, that church that I was praying would be diverse and led by people who understood diversity. Do you know who the pastor of that church is today? I wasn't ready. I had no idea. If God would have told me on that day, on that couch, when I got that email and I prayed that prayer and I said, God, help this church be all that it needs to be. He said, okay, honey, put your boots on. And I started walking out a story that I had no idea lined up with ministry. I thought I was just taking care of babies and going to school. He says, oh no, you prayed a prayer, remember? Walk this out. Are you praying prayers over people and you wonder why God's not doing anything? What if you're the Boaz in somebody's story? What if you're praying prayers and God says, okay. And I think sometimes we think prayers should be answered immediately. It took 10.5 years for that prayer to unfold. A whole lot of diapers. In 10 years. I was really nervous about coming back here to speak, and the thing that I was most nervous about, can I just be real honest with you, doctor? I don't even know what to call you. I was really nervous about all my piercings, right? If you get close to me, I probably have more piercings than anybody in the room. When I went to Beaumont to pastor, I went first as second chair. I was their executive pastor for 4 years before I became their lead pastor. And while my family was very diverse and while my family very much reflected our community and our church, I look like a soccer mom. Per capita, Beaumont sits as the third highest crime rate in cities in the United States. Soccer moms don't have a whole lot of footing. Cities like that. And I asked asked God, I said, God, how can I walk into these situations? How can I walk in with authority? How can I walk into the margins of people's lives and they not go, who's that fat lady? Now, I'm not going to say that God anointed my nose piercing. But can I tell you that my nose piercing lets me walk into stories that nobody else would let me in? I can walk up to a family who's hurting and broken, and I'm not even going to tell you the terribleness that I walk into. And if I look like a soccer mom and I rolled up in my Honda, they would be like, that white lady has nothing for me. But when I roll in and my Christian rap is, I hate Christian rap, but I play it all the time. It's thumping out my car, and I get out with all my piercings, and I say, honey, what can I do for you? She said, oh, sister, I've been waiting on you. God writes beautiful stories. It's my favorite thing. I say it over and over and over. Because you see, it's really hard for me to get up here and tell you my story. I don't like to talk about me because my life is not about me. My life is about the fact that I surrendered all to Jesus Christ. And he said, Rachel, hang on. I wanted to get up here and I wanted to preach you this amazing sermon about the lady and her, when she was anointed by Jesus. He walked on the water and all this crazy stuff happened, and that's what I wanted to preach about tonight. And he said, no, I need you to just share you. And I'm like, I don't like that part. Because I don't want anybody to think this is about me. For God to write a beautiful story, do you know who the author has to be? God. Do you know what we do sometimes? We go, God, I don't like this story. This story isn't very nice. This chapter is terrible. Give me that pen. But we wonder why the story unfolds the way it does, and we don't come out the hero. God is writing the story. Who do you think is going to be the hero? Right? It's not going to be me. And when we can surrender ourselves to the fact that we are part of a story, that if we let God write it, he will write the most incredible. I can't make this stuff up. If I had tried to write this story, I would have tried to have written Rachel Medlin as the hero. And it would have been an epic failure. But when you let God write a story, it's going to have some chapters that you just don't get answers for. One of my favorite scriptures sits in Psalms 18, down around verse 29. It says, with my God, I can scale a wall. So many times we encounter things in life and we think that God is going to give us all the answers. The world tells us, just break the wall down. Just push through. Break through the barriers. God said, I never said I was that kind of God. And we come up against walls and we go, God, I'm stuck here. I'm stuck here on this journey. I'm going to stand here at this wall until you give me all the answers that I want. And he says, we're going to be standing there a while. Because I'm the creator of the universe and your tiny little brain is not going to hold my great big story. It says, with my God, I can scale a wall. What would happen if when I encountered that wall, when I didn't get the answers to my questions, when the terrible parts of my story don't seem to make sense, and instead of going, God, 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 I went, God, help me up. Because you see, I have all these moments in my story where God goes, come on, Rachel. Come on, Rachel. And at the time, it was a wall. At the time, it was this chapter in my life that didn't make sense. It was this time where I was like, oh, can we just skip to the next chapter? But something happens when you're this far down in the story and you look back, all of those walls become altars. Do you remember what altars are in the Old Testament? They're places where you bring your kids back to and go, look what God did here. Every story that I don't have, I don't know why I didn't get to raise James. But can I tell you, on that day, God gave me what it took to love 15 babies and give them back. understand why all the rest of the hurts are in my story. All the questions are unanswered. But when I look back, I go, oh, God was there. So many times we think that God is going to write this beautiful story. You can't have a healing without a hurt. The only way you get a miracle is if there's broken. I think we forget that sometimes. So I know I've rambled on. I know you're like, wow, that was weird. Sorry, it's me. But as I give it all back to the pastor, because this is his church, these are his people. Can I ask you, maybe where are you in the parts of my story that there's probably not a whole lot of people in here got six kids that are two different colors. So I'm not saying your story lines up exactly like mine, but maybe you're standing at a wall and you've been asking God for answers for a long time and he says, sorry, I'm not going to give you the answers, but will you let me keep writing? Maybe you're praying prayers over people in your church, in your community, and you're wondering, why isn't God answering? And God's going, because you ain't doing anything. I don't know. That's what's cool about God. Is he told every one of you something different. What are you going to walk away with tonight? Pastor.